RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
So, to the NZSAS report, New Zealand Security Threat Environment, an assessment by the New Zealand Security Intelligence Service, in which they identified politically motivated violent extremism as a risk. The most common PMVE narratives focusing on anti-authority themes driven by conspiracy theories, misinformation and disinformation, in some cases produced by foreign states, although not targeted specifically at NZ, and New Zealand-based PMVE adherents moving past their opposition to COVID-19 mandates and now focusing on other domestic political issues, where they seek to exploit polarizing issues to further spread their beliefs. To talk about this, Mairi Ledbetter. She was the media spokesperson for the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament in the 80s and early 90s. She has campaigned for justice in West Papua and East Timor and is the author of See No Evil, New Zealand's Betrayal of the People of West Papua. She has another book out soon, mid-October, The Enemy Within, The Human Cost of State Surveillance in Aotearoa, New Zealand. And we will ask her about her book before we're done chatting with Mairi Ledbetter, who is with us right now. Mairi, welcome to RCR. Thanks for coming on this morning.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And great to hear a name, well, from the past, because I don't think I've heard your name mentioned for a while, Mairi, but I certainly remember your name from back in the day. So nice to meet you on air, as it's turned out.
Maybe I lead a quieter life these days.
Yeah, well, maybe not after this. You never know who's listening. Anyway, what did you make of the NZSIS report, New Zealand Security Threat Environment, an assessment by the NZSIS? What did you make of it?
Okay, so it's sort of difficult in some ways to know what to make of it because it talks in rather opaque terms about foreign interference and violent extremism and even gives some examples, but they're all, of course, anonymous and you've got no way to test the accuracy of the charges. I guess the thing for me is that having been sort of immersed in looking at the SIS throughout its history and the SIS predecessors, because surveillance and a sort of separate surveillance service goes way back. That's why my book mentions a century of surveillance.
Yeah.
And sort of looking back, I came to the conclusion that ultimately a secretive service like the SIS does more harm than good.
Oh, really?
In terms of, Yeah, I'd say so. If you look back on the record of the, I mean, I've used in my book examples of many extremely prominent individuals, important people who contributed to our society, whose careers were, well, there was strong attempts to derail their careers by the SIS. Yep. The SIS didn't always succeed. Sometimes the individuals themselves won out because they were such great people. But, you know, all that resource, spying on, looking into people's lives, using informers, which causes problems in terms of trust in the community and trust in organisations, I think that did far more harm than good.
Where do they come from? Where do they get their people from? Do we know?
Well, that's another interesting thing about the SIS. The only person whose name we're allowed to know is the Director General. We don't know the other staff. And if you get a letter from the SIS, which happens to me because I've been, you know, trying to get material to be classified and material about, for example, my father. I tried to get my father's file and succeeded in the end. So I had a bit of correspondence going with the SIS over that. And it's always, you know, you're a Mairi, but it just gets signed NZSIS.
They've got their own signature, have they? They've got a little signature for themselves. Okay, well, that's interesting. So they are like super secret.
Yes, I don't think we really know much about their staff. It's not easy to find out. Back in the day, if you go back in the day to the 1960s, activists were very concerned about the SIS and its operation during Cold War times. And there were scandals about students being spied on and so on. Hmm. And some activists decided they were going to reverse the procedure and spy on the SIS agents, and they even produced a list of agents, which was a bit contested, but I think it was to a certain degree accurate.
That would have freaked them out.
But after that, they changed. but after that, they changed the law, and it became illegal to name an SIS agent.
Do we know if we even control them?
That's it. I mean, there are oversight mechanisms. There is a parliamentary committee, but it meets very rarely, and any material presented to that oversight committee is, not sort of operational material. So, yeah, in some ways it's a sort of a circular process, isn't it? They have made efforts, I think, to improve the oversight. There's an Inspector General of Intelligence and Security, and sometimes, he or she has produced some interesting reports, but you can't go back and check the material that person looked at to see did he get it right or not. You've sort of, it's all a trust me process. Ultimately the Prime Minister is sort of in charge, but does he have time to go and sit down and find out everything that's happening in the SIS? I'm sure he doesn't.
And can he or she direct them in any way? Because if we don't know, how do we know?
Well, I think that lack of transparency, that lack of democratic transparency is probably the thing that most concerns me. When I went through it all and thought about all the various, I mean, you can't deny that there, that we do face threats. And I mean, there's another story about a school in Auckland, which has been subjected to rather horrific, threatening video. You can't deny that these things happen, and they have to be dealt with. But I kind of come back to the point of view that, generally speaking, the best people to deal with these things are the police. I mean, what's happened there, sending a threatening video, is definitely a crime, and the police will deal with it. Mm. And if you go back through our history and look at other threats, like and horrible things that have happened, the mosque murders, a murder of a trade union caretaker back in 1984.
Ernie Abbott.
The bombing of the rain. Hmm. Yes, that's the one. Ernie Abbott, indeed, yeah.
Rainbow Warrior, yep.
The Rainbow Warrior. When you look at these things, which agency played the critical role? Well,
it was the police.
It was the police. Hmm. And the police have a certain amount of transparency. I don't want to sound too much like a cheerleader for the police. They make mistakes too. Of course they do. But when they have made mistakes, for instance, think of the events in Te Uruwera in 2007, where the police were seen to have gone, way over the line and threatened a vulnerable community and threatened children and so on in their hunt for elusive terrorists. They actually went back on that. They went down to Te Uruwera, they made a very formal apology, they looked into everything they'd done, and we as the public could ask for that to happen and for it to be done. It's that transparency, I think, that's important. Where if you look at the SIS, there actually is no real transparency. And that's a huge worry in terms of their history of getting things very, very wrong at times. I mean, one of the most obvious things they got wrong was the situation of Ahmed Zawi. They determined that he was a threat to our security when he was nothing of the sort. He was a legitimate politician who was got offside with his own government, which had become very impressive, came here seeking asylum. And instead of that, he was detained for, altogether 7 or 8 years. And a security certificate was imposed on him.
Well, wasn't it because he flushed the passport down the loo or some horrible thing like that?
Well, that's,
I remember that being reported.
that's often said about asylum seekers. But, one of the weirdest things was that he was interviewed at the airport by a rather inexperienced customs officer who misunderstood his pronunciation and thought he was talking about the militant group involved in Algerian politics at the time when he was in fact talking about the political party, the legitimate political party that he had been elected to represent.
And 7 years later,
well, yeah, it wasn't the only reason, I suppose.
I know.
I think probably one of the key reasons behind it all and the reason why it took so long was because we were receiving pressure from our allies in the West who were saying, you know, you've got to do this sort of thing. You've got to try and identify people that we don't like very much. So, you know, that's, I suppose, another thing that worries me is that the report talks about foreign interference.
Yeah, who's doing the interfering? Who's doing the interfering?
Who's doing the interfering, exactly. And if you boil it all down, the only countries that really get mentioned are China, Russia, and I think Iran. So it's, to me, it's a hark back to the old Cold War days, you know, when we feared Reds under the bed and all that sort of thing. And nobody was allowed to, you know, at certain stages of our history, it was even considered seditious to want to read a book about communism or a volume of Lenin's works had to be locked away in the library. So that's the kind of oppressive thing that you can get into once you start talking about foreign influence, but only meaning one side of the case and not both.
Yeah, those countries that you mentioned, China is difficult for us, isn't it? Because we've got $38 billion of two-way trade or thereabouts, only 13 or something billion between us and the United States, so way smaller. Our economic viability, in a way, depends to a certain extent on China, yet they're kind of an enemy at the same time, it seems. Anyway, according to the NZSIS.
Yes. I don't think that...
It's an awkward situation to be in.
Are they our enemy? They're, you know, China, there's lots of things we could say about China and its human rights record, but does that mean they're threatening us in any way? They want to be involved with us economically, and to some extent that's to our advantage. I don't believe they do threaten us, and I think that's wrong to see them as a threat, and doing so is probably the biggest danger in a way. We're just going to go back into Cold War status of building up tension. We need to be reducing tension and encouraging dialogue and openness, and that openness can include criticism of China, must include criticism of China, but there's no reason why we can't dialogue with them and cooperate with them where it's in our interest to do so.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because many would argue, and I probably would argue as well, that the support of Ukraine against Russia has resulted in hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian deaths.
Yes.
Fodder, cannon fodder at the front line. There's no way they can win. It just can't happen. Russia's too big, it's too powerful, it's too full of resources. Nationalistic spirit is too strong. The president, no matter what you hear, is too popular. They can never win. Yet here we are, kind of jumping through the hoops of the country that is making that happen. That is the United States. How can we do that? In all conscience, how can we do that? Is the big question for me anyway.
Yes. Well, I'm not an expert on Ukraine, but I just remember that right at the start of the war, there were reasonable prospects of negotiation and a ceasefire and so on. But nowadays we seem to have gone so far along that no one even raises those prospects. It's very sad. It's incredibly sad for the people of Ukraine. You can't see.
Well, if we've got a problem, I guess the point is we've got a problem with China's human right. Okay, well, we should have a problem with everyone's position on human rights, shouldn't we, to be consistent? And here we are, we just ignore this.
Yes, yeah, that's right. I mean, that's what the United Nations is set for, isn't it? It's got endless mechanisms for looking at each country, a universal periodic review process which examines every country's human rights records, including ours, and comes up with criticisms. None of us are perfect, by no means.
Who else is engaging in foreign interference, according to NZSIS? I've mentioned China. I think you've mentioned Russia. There must be other countries spying on us.
Well, you're going to go back, I suppose, to the thought, what are we keeping secret? You know, is this economic issues or military issues? We are ourselves spying on other nations, of course. Through our Waihopai base, we spy on other nations throughout the Pacific. And we've been exposed as doing that through WikiLeaks and others, even down to sort of spying on people who aren't state actors, but in the case of someone in the Solomon Islands, an anti-corruption worker. So, you know, our neighbours have a reason to be worried about us, in a sense, because we spy on them, and the spying that we do is shared with our allies, with the United States. Sometimes we don't even get to know what the content is of the material that we're sharing.
Because we should know who in our name we are spying on, shouldn't we?
We should. We should. Yeah, that's probably going a little bit outside the SIS and more into the territory of the GCSB,
okay,
which is
right.
the agency in charge of Waihopai. But, of course, these days of electronic wizardry, the two agencies do work fairly closely together, and sometimes it's hard to know which one takes which role.
It's interesting they talk about politically motivated violent extremism, PMVE, for those who don't want to say the whole thing. And the most common narratives there focusing on anti-authority themes driven by conspiracy theories. I'm so over that. Misinformation and disinformation, these are new words. We know that they're loaded, weaponized, and used in certain ways. And in some cases produced by foreign states, although not targeted specifically at New Zealand. And, of course, that kind of ropes in what's been happening recently during the COVID-19 mandates. There were a lot of conspiracy theorists then. There was a lot of mis and disinformation, mainly from the government. And I think Rebecca Kitteridge, she's still the head of the NZSIS, or is that GCSB? I might be getting confused between the two.
NZSIS.
Yeah, she came out at the time and was talking about, you know, if anyone looks weird or saying anything weird, tell us, dob them in. I'm wondering if a lot more of this attention to what they call politically motivated violent extremism. And there have been a few cases, but I don't see it everywhere. It could be missing something. Has now become a sort of apparatus of, I don't know, control, cancellation, and, you know, surveillance. Our basic rights are under threat from that. What do you think about that?
Well, I'm personally not a fan for censorship. Cancellation, or I think we need to have. I'm not a fan for hate speech. That's the other thing I was going to mention. I think that's too hard to define. It's a very subjective term.
Absolutely.
So I think that our best, you know, oxygen is the best disinfectant. Our best protection against those sorts of extreme ideas, if you like, is open, free discussion, open, you know, I mean, there are people who say bad and offensive things, but to shut them down probably makes things worse. You know, I'm very much a pro-vaxxer myself, but I'm open to hearing the other side. I'm probably going to get a bit worked up when I hear it, but no harm in hearing it and debating it, you know.
Yeah, but to be surveilled because you might have a particular, and people were, they were, I know they were, a particular view on something, which now is looking like, with respect to you, a disaster. That sends a real chill, and it seems to be happening in other like countries, other Five Eyes countries too. You know, you're seeing that in the UK. They're scraping with AI now. Social media and locking people up for just expressing views.
Yeah.
And the state intelligence apparatus is being brought in behind that to make that happen.
It's very, I think that if you go back and look again at the events that happened in Te Uruwera, it's very hard to distinguish between blowhard talk and a real threat. And that whole case sort of shows that. I mean, people were recorded saying things that's pretty terrible, but they were saying them not expecting to be overheard and in a context with friends where that, you know, sort of freedom felt okay. And it didn't necessarily translate into any real world threat. I think the other thing about this report, if you go all through it, at the end of the day, they come up saying the biggest threat that we face perhaps is from a lone wolf. Yeah. So one poor, misguided individual who, you know, we can't argue that he wouldn't potentially be dangerous because we've seen that happen. We saw it happen in New Lynn. We saw it happen in the mosque murders. Absolutely shocking and terrible, but very, very difficult to prevent.
It's like a needle in a haystack, right? Trying to find an...
Yeah, it's a needle. It's an absolute needle in a haystack. I read the mosque report very carefully and I came out at the end feeling there wasn't too much fault, really, in terms of not having detected him because of the way he, you know, he operated. But there was a fault, in my opinion, I feel very strongly about this, in making available to him guns, you know, heavy assault weapons.
Yeah, and a license.
And a license. That is something we can address, but we seem to be going backwards on that one and reversing the gun control laws. You know, I think that would have been the main thing that would have made a difference then.
So is there any way, from your understanding, that we can test, well, I suppose if it's all anonymous and it's all hidden, we can't, but we can't test the accuracy of any of these claims by the NZSIS. We just have to take them on their word.
Yes, that's right. Individuals, of course, can ask the SIS to give them any material that they hold on them. That's possible under the Privacy Act, and that's the foundation for quite a bit of my book because I was able to get the released records from myself and members of my family. And
yeah. What do they say? Sorry to jump in, but what do they say? Were they accurate?
About me?
Yeah.
Well, as far as I was concerned, they started monitoring me when I was 10 years old.
What?
That is true. And my brother at 11. Well, we were members of a notorious communist family, you see. So
okay. So even the kids,
Yeah. Well, I was delivering a Communist Party paper to a neighbour. That was the...
Okay.
I mean, it's hard not to laugh, isn't it? It really is very strange. So mostly I could kind of laugh it off, but not entirely, because some of the organisations I was involved in, we were dealing with people who weren't New Zealanders. For example, I was in the Philippines Solidarity Network, and some of the people that were involved in the network or that we might be communicating with did not have the protection of New Zealand law, and we may have completely unwittingly exposed them. That was the thing that really worried me.
Right.
You know, they may have been pursuing an asylum claim or something like that, and here was the SIS informant noting everything that happened in our group. See, and that's another aspect. Most of the groups that I've been involved in terms of our meetings, it's just a small number of people at a committee meeting, often in a private home. And it's pretty disturbing later on to find out that one of your number was an informant.
Oh, yeah, that would be, yeah.
So I never personally felt at all motivated to identify who that person might or might not have been, but you can see that it does reduce trust and confidence. And community organisations need that trust and confidence to operate, you know. It's sort of part of the lifeblood of any community organisation.
Yeah, gosh, I'm stunned at the ages. And also, you know, who was that informant in there? I suppose you could probably, I don't know, think of maybe one or two.
There are one or two spies who have outed themselves over the years and told these stories. So, yeah, we've got a few like that to give us a bit of insight into.
I'm looking over my shoulder now.
Yeah. Anyway, I hope you hope you'll be interested enough to read the book when it comes out.
No, I will be. It sounds fascinating. I've become more interested in this sort of thing. I want to get your response to rules-based order versus international law. Are they the same thing or are they completely different?
No, I think rules-based order is not the same as international law. And I think you can very easily see that it's not if you look at the situation in Gaza and the fact that the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court have both made rulings on the situation there. But New Zealand, United States, supporters of the rules-based order are not doing anything to support those institutions. We are a state party to the International Court of to the Genocide Convention, which is what the International Court of Justice based its findings on. So we have a responsibility under that convention to do all we can to stop the genocide, which would mean, in our case, perhaps signing up to support the ICJ process. It could mean, you know, obviously calling for a ceasefire, but doing more than that, you know, really seriously acting in good faith towards the court would involve us in standing up for justice for the people of Gaza and, you know, doing all the things that we already do in some ways for Ukraine, which is allow families with residents here to bring their families to New Zealand. We don't do that. We don't give them visas. We don't do anything to upset Israel. So I don't think you can say rules-based order does not mean international law.
Israel's interesting because we know that there's a lot of Israeli influence in American politics. I think it's pretty clear. Do you suspect that there is a level of influence in our political machinery here too? Similar?
Oh, some people have documented it. No doubt about it. It's not as strong as in America, but it certainly happens. Some academics have documented it. Can't just name them off the top of my head, but yeah.
Yeah,
I guess we've been a bit lucky. We've at least been able to do our weekly demonstrations and all the other actions that have happened around the war in Gaza unhindered. You know, it hasn't been like America where they academics and the students are persecuted for demonstrating for Palestine.
Yeah.
No, Israel would be a good example, and it's also a historical example, actually, because there were Israelis who managed to get themselves New Zealand passports by fraudulent means, and the SIS didn't discover them. They weren't looking in that direction. They're never looking in that direction.
Well, that's interesting because they've missed a few, haven't they? And I know the lone wolf's hard to find, but you mentioned the most recent case, the school lockdown. I think there was an attack in a supermarket 6-8 months ago. That person was kind of known about in the neighbourhood. And, of course, the mosque shootings. So I just wonder ultimately if for when it really comes to, you know, stopping these horrible things happening, if they actually are worth the money.
Well, I'd say not. I'd say, you know, we could just rely on the police. It may be that we have to, you know, make a few adjustments. For example, that, you know, to the GCSB has a cybersecurity role, which is important for all of us. So we'd probably need to make that back into a standalone institution. And, you know, maybe we'd have to resource the police slightly better. But, we could save ourselves an awful lot of money by not having these secretive, non-transparent organisations like the NZSIS and the GCSB. It's a contentious thought, and I guess one of the contentious claims, and I think one of my real hopes is that this book will spark a bit of a dialogue and people will start thinking about it, because I think that's what we need to do. We need to have a debate and a dialogue about it.
Last question, net benefit or net harm, the NZSIS to New Zealand? Weighing it all up, what do you reckon?
I'd say net harm, definitely net harm. Net harm in personal lives and lack of trust, waste of resources, and yeah, just building up a following our allies far too closely. That's, yeah, definitely net harm.
Okay, and the book is out mid-October. That's not long to wait. The Enemy Within, The Human Cost of State Surveillance in Aotearoa, New Zealand. And what would be the best way to get hold of a copy? Mairi, do you reckon?
Okay. So the publisher is Cotton and Burton, Nelson-based publisher Cotton and Burton. I don't know.
We'll look into it. We'll find the website when it comes out and we'll put it over.
Oh, thank you. That'd be great. Yeah.
And it's been really interesting speaking with you. It's great to hear your name again. Great to hear your voice.
Oh, thank you very much.
Mairi Ledbetter, thanks for coming on RCR and all the best with the book.
Okay, thank you very much.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.